This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Investigation into the targeted killing abroad by the U.S. and other governments.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 24th, 2013. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Joey G. This afternoon, 100 people from We Are Oregon gathered outside the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to call for a moratorium on foreclosure evictions. Today's action comes a week after the Austin family was forcibly evicted from their home of 27 years by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, despite having made their mortgage payments. The officers waited until Ron Austin had gone to work at 5 a.m. when Debbie and her two children were alone, then entered the home to forcibly evict the family at the demand of the publicly owned and funded mortgage regulator Fannie Mae. Now the family, like many in our community, is houseless, staying with friends and keeping up the fight to regain their home of 27 years. The sheriffs continued to evict despite demands for a moratorium and court rulings against banks for foreclosure fraud. Reporter Jamie Partridge was at the rally this afternoon and spoke to KBOO's Jacob Soderberg from the scene.
Jamie, can you give us an idea of what the scene is there this afternoon?
Yeah, we're out here on the street in front of the Multnomah County building. There's about 50 demonstrators calling for a moratorium on evictions. Kerry Coe is here and can talk about what's happening right here at the sheriff's office.
Great. So, Carrie, can you tell us what the demands are of today's protest?
The demands of today's protest are no more evictions at all. We want a moratorium from the sheriff on all evictions. And, that's our primary demand, and we are here at the sheriff's office to follow through on that demand. Here, there's a lot of people, a lot of chanting, and so it's a pretty exciting action. People are chanting, banks got bailed out, people got sold out. Right now we're marching into the lobby of the Multnomah County Sheriff's building here on 5th and Hawthorne, or Grand and Hawthorne. And we actually have just announced so Debbie and some folks from We Are Oregon were upstairs meeting with the sheriff, issuing the demand on a moratorium on evictions. The sheriff apparently would not meet those demands, and so we have let the sheriff know that there is a group of people in his office prepared to stay and risk arrest until he meets those demands.
And what reason did the Multnomah County Sheriff give for wanting to continue these foreclosure evictions?
The sheriff has no reason to continue doing evictions. The sheriff could immediately issue a moratorium. We are prepared here. People are prepared to get arrested to increase the pressure on him to pursue that moratorium. And if he doesn't meet the demand today, then tomorrow we will continue our fight and we'll develop new creative tactics and strategies to apply that pressure.
We've heard from people at the state and federal level that there is now money available for homeowners that are being foreclosed on. How is it that these evictions are continuing? Are people not able to access those programs?
So that program, for what it's worth, is essentially the state saying that they fraudulently issued evictions and mortgages to people. And so there is money available, but those programs are scant. They're scarce. And, you know, people are getting a small fraction of what their home is actually worth. So in addition to, them being relatively inaccessible to people that are in deep pain and suffering foreclosure, it's also not the answer. The answer isn't to give people a few thousand dollars and send them on their way. The answer is to stop evicting people from the houses that they're in. We don't need new mortgages for people. We need people to stay in the houses that they're in. So those programs, while I think are more of an admittal of wrongdoing than a solution to the problem.
That was Kerry Coe with the group We Are Oregon, speaking with us from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in southeast Portland, where a number of demonstrators are currently staging a sit-in and risking arrest to call for a moratorium on foreclosure evictions.
We are now in the second week of the trial of local teen Mohamed Mohamed, and KBOO News is continuing its live coverage from the federal court in Portland. Mohamed is charged with allegedly attempting to blow up the Christmas tree lighting at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland in 2010. But his attorneys argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer is at the courthouse and joins us live for an update. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thank you for joining us. Today, the FBI's lead agent testified about over 150 emails Mohamed sent to Islamic editor Samir Khan. Did the jury get to see any of the actual texts of these exchanges? And can you give a little bit more information about them?
That's an interesting case. They've been arguing about this email evidence since day one, really. And kind of the problem is there are 150 of them and over 2,000 text messages. And so the judge didn't know what to do with it. They are going to be available to the jury. And today, Special Agent Ryan Dwyer from the FBI summarized the emails. And again, the defense was complaining, this isn't the summary, this is cherry-picking some evidence. But in any case, the judge allowed them to proceed that way. And Agent Dwyer summarized or cherry-picked emails starting in December 2008 when Mohamed was just 17. We learned that the defendant was frustrated that the world was full of lobbyists who ran the world. And we also saw the defendant applying to Samir Khan to be a writer for the Jihad Recollections. And really the rest of the morning was taking up by the prosecution going through this online magazine, Jihad Recollections, that Mohamed contributed to. The presentation of this magazine was also objected to by the defense because it was arguing for guilt by association. The judge allowed this, and we learned that Osama bin Laden had an article on worldwide jihad in the same issue as the defendant's article on staying in shape without weights. So I would say that's guilt by association. It was allowed to go forward. Again, it's just too much stuff to go through. I guess in general, the government was arguing that the emails show that the defendant was dangerous. A lot of the testimony was tedious, and then the jury seemed pretty bored. On cross-examination, public defender Wax brought up FBI reports stating that Mohamed would not conduct any terrorist act without direct supervision from an FBI agent, which seemed to really go to the entrapment. He wasn't capable of pulling this off by himself. This taken together with earlier FBI reports stating that due to his immaturity and instability, the defendant would jeopardize any undercover operation. It seems like a pretty strong argument for entrapment. The defense also argued that Mohamed was more interested in writing than fighting, quoting an email that read, media is more important than bullets. The defense also presented text messages showing that Mohamed was conflicted and heavily using marijuana and alcohol. Texts in that regard include, you got to connect with the dub. I'm trying to stop partying, so showing he's conflicted, and then looking for a blunt, and, hey, I just got a gallon of vodka and a dub of weed, LOL. Those are text messages. Maybe the most relevant text message was from the defendant on August 1st, 2010. Now, this was just 2 days after the first face-to-face meeting with undercover Agent Youssef. And the text read, hey, I've got to take a drug test for a job at Nike. Can you get me some clean pee? So I think these messages show that Mohamed was heavily using marijuana throughout the undercover operation, and then the government knew about it.
I see. And I believe the argument was brought up maybe in the past couple days that that his desire to lead a two-sided life, one foot in strict Islamic rule and another foot in college partying, and that made him easily manipulatable. Can you give any more information on this, or does this have any validity?
It seems like the defense is arguing that. The defense has been arguing all along that the agents manipulate the defendant on the small level, on everyday conversation level. Like they give him the chance to get out. You can stop. Then they say, this isn't for everyone. Oh, aren't you great? Aren't you brave? So they're manipulating him sort of step by step. But they also created this larger fantasy of this overseas world where he's pious and he's a poet and he's a leader of the brothers. And from part of his writings from the university, that's what he really wants, but he keeps getting pulled back into alcohol and marijuana. So I think it does play an important role. It's part of the fantasy world created by the FBI to get Mohammed to do what they want, to follow orders.
I see. And did we hear at all about how the government obtained these emails and these text messages that were the subject of proceedings today?
It came up a few times, and apparently it was court allowed. So they went to they did go to a judge to get some kind of surveillance. Okay.
All right. And briefly to close, do you have any expectations as to where the trial will go tomorrow?
Well, I think tomorrow we're going to start hearing from expert witnesses, I think, about the kind of bomb it is. I don't expect that to be very interesting. It's kind of dotting your I's and crossing your T's. I think what's going to happen next is interesting, is continuing on the marijuana case. I think the defense is going to say that not only did they control him with mind techniques, but they also controlled him with drugs.
I see. Well, thank you very much, Joe, for speaking with us. Yes, you're welcome. We've been talking with KBOO reporter Joe Meyer, reporting live from outside the federal courtroom in Portland, where Mohammed Mohammed is facing the potential of life in prison if found guilty of terrorism charges.
Yesterday, Mayor Charles Hales eliminated $395,000 worth of proposed funding for summer youth programs. These summer internship programs for at-risk youth run by Workman Work Systems Incorporated were a top priority for former Mayor Sam Adams. According to a press release from Mayor Hales' chief of staff, these cuts are simply reflective of the tough fiscal reality that Mayor Hales and the City Council are facing. Although Hales campaigned on a back-to-basics approach to government, he did also speak quite a bit about improving education. The Work System summer internship programs are targeted towards students at risk for dropping out of school. According to Work System's executive director, Andrew McGough, the proposal was supposed to go to the City Council in December of last year. Had this happened, the spending would have likely been approved unanimously. McGough indicated that although Work Systems is disappointed, they understand that if the money's not there, it's not there. The city has had to face other tough budget cuts due to a $25 million deficit.
Workers' rights groups Jobs with Justice named the Metro Regional Government as their Scrooge of the Year in late 2012. For over 2 years, SEIU Local 49 and Laborers Local 483 in Portland have been calling on Metro to end their use of seasonal, low-wage workers with no job security for custodial positions. Yesterday evening, members of Jobs for Justice delivered the award in person to Metro's Southeast Portland headquarters. KBOO's Robin Ryan was on the scene and spoke with Will Lang, Property Services Director for SEIU Local 49.
Tonight, we've sent Metro a strong message that they need to contract with a responsible janitorial company, the same as the City of Portland does, the same as Multnomah County does, and all the other major public agencies in our area. Metro should not be balancing their budgets or cutting back on the backs of the hardworking folks that clean their building by outsourcing to a low-road, low-wage, no-benefit, union-busting janitorial firm.
What was with the guy in the Santa suit?
Our union worked together with the laborers' union to highlight what's going on with Oregon Metro. And Oregon Metro won a prestigious dishonor of the Scrooge of the Year Award, which we delivered to them tonight. By giving them a certificate and writing a poem about their union-busting activities, both for their park seasonal workers and for their janitors.
And how was Metro selected as the receiver of the Scrooge Award?
They got the most votes as part of a fundraising effort that was done on behalf of Jobs with Justice by SEIU, my union, working together with the Laborers Union.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Robin.
We're talking with Will of the SEIU 49.
On Tuesday, KBOO News reported on a demonstration challenging wage theft by Yaw's top-notch restaurant in Northeast Portland. Today, the employees announced a victory in their struggle to receive the back pay owed to them by their boss. 10 workers were paid $1,200 in back wages owed to them by their employer. Stephen Perriman worked at Yaw's top-notch until about a month ago. He spoke with KBOO today about today's victory for himself and other employees of the restaurant.
There had been rumors of problems going on with management and payroll for a few months before I left, and then it kind of came to a head when people started mysteriously disappearing from our schedules, and they were never really heard from. They would occasionally show up, and they would be escorted from the premises, And then about a few days before the new year, I was myself removed from our schedule. And I realized that, in fact, they did owe me quite a lot of money, and that there was a sizable group of former employees that were in the same situation. A friend of one of the other employees actually put us in contact, and then from there we just set up a few meetings and tried to coordinate what exactly we were going to do about it. We developed a plan for, like, a delegation of sorts to collectively demand wages that were pretty much illegally deducted and essentially stolen from us. We had about a month's worth of public action and public relations work planned out if things went south. We worked with representatives from both We Are Oregon and the Portland chapter of International Workers of the World, the IWW. Certain members of their management were belligerent and had originally refused to pay, but certain other members of the organization recognized the dilemma and were actually quite helpful. Over the last few days, I've been in contact with them, and we reached a resolution this morning.
That was Stephen Perriman, a former employee at Yaw's Top Notch, who was one of the 10 workers that received unpaid back wages today after a public campaign against their employer.
Oregon State Representative Mitch Greenlick from Portland is sponsoring a bill that would force smokers to receive a doctor's note to buy a pack of cigarettes. The proposed bill, if passed, would consider cigarettes a Schedule III controlled substance, along with ketamine and anabolic steroids. This means that cigarettes would be illegal without a doctor's prescription. Offenders would face fines of up to $6,000, 1 year in jail, or both. Most political analysts in the state agree that the bill is extremely unlikely to pass.
The Center for Biological Diversity went to court today in Alameda County, California, to enforce an existing state law that protects people and the environment from unregulated fracking. Under California law, any underground injection carried out by the oil and gas industry must meet safeguards and disclosure requirements. The process of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, clearly involves injection of chemicals and water to extract natural gas. As of now, the state does not monitor or regulate this controversial practice. Dangers reported by fracking include more than 1,000 cases of water contamination and the emission of hazardous air pollutants such as methane. The lawsuit also claims that fracking could increase seismic activity in one of the nation's most earthquake-prone states. Compliance with California's existing oil and gas regulations would require disclosure of all fracking chemicals, along with studies to evaluate the potential migration of fracking fluids. State regulators have only issued a discussion draft of new regulations in response to growing public concern. In its lawsuit, the Center for Biological Diversity demands that fracking in California needs to stop, and regulators must implement the requirements already in place in California law.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy, with a steady temperature around 44 degrees. The rain is likely to continue into the evening, with lows expected to reach 40 degrees.
It's 5:19, and it's now time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Perhaps you thought that surely the far right wing in American politics couldn't get any nuttier. If so, you clearly hadn't factored in Glenn Beck. Since losing his glory spot as a Fox TV yakety yacker, Beck has been less visible, but no less busy. Continuing to promote himself as leader of the political wacky and still delighting them as the P.T. Barnum of conspiracy theories. His hottest-selling shtick in recent months is a piece of fear-mongering about an entity that few other people in the world consider at all fearsome, the United Nations. Agenda 21, wails the Beckster on his subscription TV show and other forums, referring to an obscure, innocuous, and non-binding resolution approved by UN members, including the U.S., 21 years ago. Be very afraid, Beck bleats in alarm, for this document lays out the secret diabolical scheme of internationalists to seize America's autonomy. Under the guise of promoting sustainable development, goes the theory, the United Nations intends to ban our suburbs, take our golf courses from us, usurp our freedoms, and impose a global dictatorship. To depict the horror of Agenda 21, the cover of Beck's new book on the topic features the UN logo looming over an American landscape which is imprisoned behind barbed wire. Subtle. Silly, too. But it's the hot new thing on the far right. Heroic lawmakers in Alabama and Tennessee have already banned any implementation of Agenda 21-style provisions in their states, even though none were proposed. Five other state legislatures are considering the same this year. And the big rumor on the right is that Barack Obama is using CIA mind control techniques to implement the UN dictatorship. This is Jim Hightower saying, do these people ever even visit reality?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Assistant U.S. Attorney General Lanny Breuer announced his intentions to resign today after receiving criticism for a television appearance. Breuer was featured on a Frontline documentary titled The Untouchables about the 2008 financial collapse, which aired on OPB earlier this week. Breuer has been criticized for going soft on financial fraud and corruption cases, though others have praised him for his prosecution of white-collar crime. Republicans applauded Breuer's departure, pointing out that he was the highest-ranking Justice Department official overseeing the botched Fast and Furious gun trafficking operation. Breuer has worked in the Justice Department's criminal division since April of 2009. Prior to that, he served as a special counsel to President Clinton during the 1998 impeachment hearings. Neither Breuer nor the Department of Justice gave an exact date for when his resignation will take effect.
The Connecticut legislature today has confirmed Andrew J. McDonnell as the first openly gay justice of the state Supreme Court. Several other states already have openly gay Supreme Court justices, including Colorado, which confirmed its first gay justice in 2010. And Vermont, which followed suit in 2011. In Connecticut this week, the vote to approve McDonnell was a landslide with 30-3 votes in the Senate and 125-20 in the House. McDonnell has elected senator in 2002 to serve Connecticut's 27th district, has been a major proponent of marriage equality and transgender rights, and helped push through the Civil Union Bill in 2005. That bill led to the 2008 Connecticut Supreme Court ruling granting same-sex couples the freedom to marry.
The Rhode Island House of Representatives passed a marriage equality bill today. The measure passed easily with 51-19 votes, although its fate in the Senate is uncertain. Rhode Island's Governor Chafee has said that he will sign the bill, although President of the Senate Teresa Piva-Weed has said she personally opposes it. Rhode Island is currently the only New England state to have not yet legalized gay marriage. Their legislative body previously voted on marriage equality in 2001, when only one member supported the measure. 2 years ago, openly gay Speaker of the House Gordon Fox dropped efforts for gay marriage legislation, choosing instead to pass civil unions for same-sex couples. In May of last year, Governor Chafee signed an executive order recognizing out-of-state marriages. 30 states currently have constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. If Rhode Island allows gay marriage, they will become the 10th state to do so.
New Mexico State Representative Republican Catherine Brown introduced a bill yesterday that would make it illegal for crime victims to abort their rape or incest-related pregnancies. House Bill 206 would legally require New Mexico's rape and incest victims to carry their pregnancies to term, so the fetus could be used as evidence in a sexual assault trial. If the bill passes, a rape or incest victim in New Mexico who ends her pregnancy would be charged with a third-degree felony for tampering with evidence and could be sentenced to up to 3 years in prison. Representative Catherine Brown, who has been endorsed by the National Right to Life organization, says that she introduced the bill with the goal of punishing the person who commits incest or rape. The bill is extremely unlikely to pass because Democrats have a majority in both chambers of New Mexico's state legislature. Nonetheless, The introduction of this bill is creating outrage among reproductive health advocates. This isn't the first time some states have gotten creative in trying to criminalize abortion. In some cases in Mississippi and Alabama, women who miscarry but are suspected of having used drugs can face criminal charges.
A top activist in the Canadian Idle No More movement for Indigenous rights was admitted to a hospital late last night after 44 days on hunger strike. Ottawa Piskit Chief Teresa Spence announced an end to her hunger strike earlier yesterday after First Nations representatives endorsed a 13-point declaration of commitments. The declaration calls for a framework to enforce treaties between the Canadian and tribal governments, as well as full implementation of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. Chief Spence was hospitalized as a precautionary measure, but was still unable to attend an honoring ceremony where she had planned to officially end her hunger strike, along with Elder Raymond Robinson. Chief Teresa Spence began her hunger strike on December 11th of last year. She is expected to leave the hospital tomorrow.
Today, 8 days in a strike by subway workers in Greece. The Greek government announced that it plans on forcing an end to the strike. Those who refuse to return to work will risk dismissal, arrest, and jail time. The strike was called to protest pay cuts that workers say would amount to 25% of their salaries. The strike has caused, and Athens prompted officials to declare a civil mobilization order that carries a 3-month to 5-year prison sentence for those who disregard it. In response, the union called for immediate strikes, which stopped all public transportation in Athens for the rest of the day. The leaders of Metro Workers Union in Athens said, quote, "We are protesting, and if they fire people, let them come. They will take us dead from here." The proposed pay cuts to subway staff are part of austerity measures being imposed in Greece in order to meet fiscal requirements by international creditors. In return, Greece received bailout loans, but the conditions that came with them only worsened the country's economic distress, with unemployment climbing higher than 26%.
Today, the United Nations announced an official investigation into targeted killings by the United States and other governments. Ben Emmerson, a British UN special reporter on counterterrorism and human rights, will be leading the inquiry. Emmerson's investigation will focus on the civilian effect, as well as the legal framework governing drone attacks in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, and the Palestinian territories. Emmerson sees the crucial need for more regulations as drone technology and tactics are here to stay. Results on the investigation will be reported in October to the United Nations General Assembly. For more information about the investigation and on the American drone campaign, I spoke with Jamil Dakwar, director of the Human Rights Program with the ACLU, which is fighting legal challenges to the U.S. targeted killing program. In his statement, Ben Emmerson said that the increasing use of drones presents a challenge to the framework of established international law. How so?
I think what he means by this is that there's an increase in the use of this technology and the use of drones and unmanned aerial technology that is also accompanied not only by surveillance, but also by the use of lethal force. And this is presenting a challenge to the international law, although the international law framework with regard to the use of lethal force is pretty clear and straightforward, whether it is in the context of outside international armed conflict, where there's no conflict between two governments or two countries, states can only use lethal force against suspects away from battlefield in extremely narrow circumstances. And they are permitted under the Constitution and international law only as a matter of a last resort to address specific, concrete, and imminent threat of deadly harm. What is not clear is the way that the government has invoked the authority to use drone attacks in Yemen and other places other than outside Afghanistan, because this program is totally secret.
On that subject, could you give us an update on the status of the Freedom of Information Act suit that the ACLU has brought against the U.S. government in relation to drones and how that would play into transparency of the program?
The ACLU brought two challenges to the U.S. targeted killing program. The first lawsuit was brought by with the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of families of three Americans killed in targeted killing strikes in Yemen in 2011. The ACLU was also litigating two lawsuits under FOIA, under the Freedom of Information Act, to obtain documents outlining the U.S. government's legal rationale and details about the program. The problem with these lawsuits, most of the cases that were brought before the court, the U.S. government has invoked all kinds of reasons not to disclose its reasoning for using drones, and it used a mix of legal arguments, including state secret standing, that it's a political question, that it's not something for the court to review the decisions of the military. And more than anything, the U.S. government has continued to shield the CIA program because some of these strikes are carried out by the CIA.
What is at risk for the U.S. administration that has so defended these types of drone attacks? How might their policies be affected by the results of this investigation?
Well, this is a real question for the government. For as far as we're concerned, we think that the government, every act should be justified and lawful under the U.S. Constitution and under international law. The U.S. cannot justify the use of force and the so-called global war on terror against Al-Qaeda to use lethal force everywhere, anywhere, and indefinitely. There has to be limits. And those limits are subscribed and very clear under international law. And we think that the U.S. Constitution also provides significant protections against violations of due process, particularly when Americans are put on kill lists. So we think that there should be accountability, there should be transparency, there should be independent investigations into these strikes. Without such measures, this program will continue to be shrouded in secrecy, will continue to be problematic. It will raise both international outcry, and now we have a UN investigation, and it will also bring more problems than it will solve problems by using a technology that other countries may have the capability.